Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar, Responding to Elder Abuse, Rights, Safety and Participation. I'm Rachel Carson, a Senior Research Fellow with the Family Law and Family Violence team here at the Institute. I would like to start by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we're meeting in Melbourne, the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and to the elders from other communities who may be participating today. Today's webinar will present an overview of elder abuse in Australia, with a focus on what it is, emerging evidence on its prevalence, its effects and risk factors, and the implications for policy and practice. We encourage you to send your questions through during the webinar for our presenters Adam and Megan to answer during the Q&A session at the end of today's presentations. Those we can't get to will be answered in the forum. Please let us know if you don't want your question published in the online forum following the presentation. CFCA webinars are recorded. The slides are available in the handout section of the GoToWebinar. And the audio, slides, transcript and recording of the webinar will be available on our website in the coming week. Now to our presenters. Adam Dean is a Senior Research Officer in the CFCA. He works across a range of knowledge translation activities, including with sector professionals to share research and practice expertise across the child, family and community welfare sector. Indeed, it's Adam that coordinates many of the CFCA webinars. Adam is the author of a recent paper on elder abuse that he will be discussing today. Megan Frost is a seasoned social worker, lawyer and mediator with over 25 years of experience working in the community services sector. Megan currently works in direct service delivery and in program design, coordination, and with management with Relationships Australia New South Wales. Megan is coordinating the implementation of a new elder mediation and support service funded by the New South Wales Government's Domestic and Family Violence Innovation Fund. I will now hand over to Adam. Please give him a warm virtual welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Rachel, for your introduction, and hello to everyone listening today. So I'll just move on to my first slide. So as Rachel said, my part of today's presentation is based on a CFCA paper that I authored titled Elder Abuse, Key Issues and Emerging Evidence. And this is available via the CFCA website for anyone interested. The paper explores three main areas, and these are the key issues involved in how elder abuse is defined, emerging evidence on its prevalence, impact, and risk factors. And it also looks at implications for policy and practice. So I'll be looking at these three broad areas today, beginning with a brief overview of the population of older people in Australia. So in Australia, older people are generally defined as adults aged 60 to 65 years and older for non-Indigenous Australians. And due to a difference in average life expectancies and cultural understandings, 45 to 50 years and older for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. In 2016, people aged 65 and older represented about 15% of the overall population in Australia. And that's a rate that's increased from about 5% in 1926 and is expected to increase to 22% of the population by 2056. This trend is known as Australia's ageing population. And as I discuss in the paper, we should be careful about how we talk about the challenges associated with an ageing population in order to avoid older people or characterising older people as a burden to society or devaluing their role and status in the community. So older people in Australia are of course, a diverse population. They represent diverse cultural backgrounds, lifestyles, and abilities. In relation to an older person's risk of abuse, there's a few key points worth mentioning here in relation to this diversity. Firstly, older people are much more likely to have a disability or a severe or profound core activity limitation compared to younger people. In 2015, around half of all older people had a disability. Secondly, like disability, the risk of dementia also increases with age. The vast majority of people living with dementia are 60 years or older. Thirdly, most older people live in private households, with only a small proportion living in care accommodation. For people living in households, about a quarter lived alone in 2015, with women more likely than men to live alone. And lastly, the need for assistance increases with age, with many older people needing assistance with a range of daily activities as they get older. So it should be noted, however, that these factors are not intrinsic to aging itself. And while these factors can represent vulnerability for older people, it's the combination of other factors, such as poor quality relationships or low social support, that can exacerbate the risk of abuse for older people. So moving to the question of what elder abuse is, it should be noted at the outset that there isn't any universal consensus about how it should be defined. However, some definitions are more widely used than others. So a widely accepted definition is one that's been adopted by the World Health Organization, and it defines elder abuse as, and I quote, a single or repeated act or lack of appropriate action occurring within any relationship where there is an expectation of trust which causes harm or distress to an older person. In this definition, there is a focus on the kinds of relationships that exist between potential perpetrators of abuse and older people. And that's one where there's an expectation of trust. So this will include those relationships built on trust with non-professionals, such as family, friends, and informal carers, as well as relationships with professionals who occupy positions of trust. Included in this definition are relationships with other older people who may also be potential perpetrators of abuse, such as spouses or partners, friends, and more debatably, peers. Beyond this general definition, there are other aspects that I don't have time to cover today, unfortunately, but these include whether potential victims of abuse should be defined purely in terms of age, for example, all adults aged 65 years or older, or whether it would be better to focus on particular at-risk populations in how we define potential victims of abuse. There is also the question of how elder abuse relates to family violence. And these are some topics that are covered in more detail in the paper. So there are different types of elder abuse. It covers a range of potential harms to an older person. So typically five types of abuse are recognized. There's physical abuse, psychological or emotional abuse, sexual abuse, financial abuse, and neglect. There is some debate about these categories and whether others should be included. For example, other types of abuse may include social abuse, chemical or medical abuse, self-neglect or abandonment. However, these are generally included in the five main types of abuse and neglect outlined here. These forms of abuse can, of course, occur together. For example, emotional abuse and financial abuse may co-occur in a pattern of polyvictimization. And it's also worth highlighting that various forms of abuse and neglect can be perpetrated and experienced in varying degrees of severity and frequency. So moving now to the question of prevalence, the first thing to note is that we don't have national prevalence data on elder abuse in Australia as yet. Most of what we know is based on international population studies. A recent meta-analysis of prevalence studies from around the world, including from lower income countries, estimated that 15.7% of older adults 60 years and older living in community settings had experienced some form of abuse in the past 12 months. Prevalence rates for particular subtypes of abuse were lower than that pooled average and ranged between about 1% and almost 12%, depending on type, with psychological abuse found to be the most prevalent. International data also indicates that higher rates of abuse are likely to occur in institutional care settings and for people with disability. So we have some idea about its prevalence elsewhere in the world, but what about Australia? So as I've just mentioned, there's currently no national prevalence data for elder abuse in Australia, but based on international data in countries similar to Australia, it has been estimated that between 2 and 14% of older people in Australia may experience some form of elder abuse every year. We also have data collected from elder abuse helplines in Australia that give us some insights into the incidence of abuse, but not its prevalence per se. So this data tends to indicate that firstly, financial and psychological abuse are the most frequently reported types, and that sons or daughters are the most frequently reported perpetrators of abuse. Elder abuse, of course, has negative impacts on older people. Broadly, negative impacts can be conceptualized as having the common effect of reducing an older person's quality of life. More specifically, it's known to have a range of particular negative impacts for older people, depending on the nature and circumstances of the abuse or neglect perpetrated. And this includes, but not limited to, psychological distress and emotional difficulties, disrupted relationships and restrictions on autonomy, compromised health, physical injury, and in the extreme cases, premature death. And it's also about the loss of assets and finances, among others. There hasn't been a lot of research on the particular impacts of elder abuse, and we should remember that this includes not only the impacts it can have on older people, but also on family members. We do know, however, that its impact can often go undetected and is sometimes difficult to quantify. In one of the few studies looking at its impacts, it was found that victims of elder abuse experienced higher rates of depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, and poor health compared to non-victims, with these effects enduring over long periods of time. So turning now to look at the emerging evidence on risk factors associated with elder abuse. Again, what is known about risk factors is largely based on international studies, and these factors relate to older people, the perpetrators, relationship types and characteristics, and also broader community and societal context. So these shouldn't be seen in isolation to each other. Rather, the risk of abuse often involves a combination of all these factors associated with victims, with perpetrators, and the context that they live in. So I've got a diagram on the screen there, and as it shows, this is an ecological model, and it's a common framework used to understand how these factors can relate to each other. So that is, there are factors relating to both an older person and a potential perpetrator that can increase the risk of abuse, and these are moderated by relationship characteristics. So that's represented by the first circle around the older person and perpetrator. And lastly, these factors may be influenced by broader environmental factors at the community, social, and cultural levels that can increase or moderate this risk. So, looking firstly at factors that are known to increase the risk of abuse for older people, the main factors to have emerged consistently across a range of studies cognitive impairment and disability, poor mental health, social isolation of older people, as well as a history of abuse, family violence, or conflict. There are also other factors, and these identified in prevalence studies, and these have included frailty, alcohol use, trauma, lower income or poverty, problem behaviours, personality traits, as well as incontinence. Unfortunately, I don't have time to get into much detail about each of these, so I'd encourage you to read the paper if you're interested. So there's also risk factors associated with perpetrators. Less is known about these. The main factors found in the research include caregiver stress, financial or emotional dependency on an older adult, poor mental health, the use of alcohol and other drugs, as well as attitudes of entitlement. There are also factors associated with relationship types and characteristics that can moderate this risk. The available evidence indicates that different types of relationships are associated with different types of abuse. In some population studies, family relationships are found to be the most common relationship type in overall cases of abuse. Other studies have found that adult children are more likely to neglect older people's care needs. On the other hand, available evidence suggests that intimate partners are more likely to be physically or psychologically abusive than other perpetrators. In addition to relationship types, there are also relationship characteristics that have been found to increase the risk of abuse. In general, emerging evidence indicates that elder abuse is more likely to occur where there's a history of family conflict in relationships, in poor quality relationships, as well as in situations of dependence or interdependence. That is where someone, and it's usually a family member, has an emotional or a financial dependence on the older person and vice versa. Overall, there is evidence to suggest that the quality of relationships and access to social supports are the most consequential factors influencing the risk of elder abuse. Finally, there are also factors that operate at the level of community and societal context that may be associated with the abuse of older people. At the community level, these factors include social isolation and exclusion. So researchers have suggested that an older person's alienation from community can increase their vulnerability to abuse. And this can occur in various ways, including through the loss of friends or families, or in the absence of formal support networks that can keep older people connected to the local community. Factors relating to institutional care settings include opportunities for peer-to-peer abuse, in particular the cohabitation of older adults who may be at increased risk of potentially perpetrating abuse, but also an increased vulnerability of victimization. Also, where present, the lack of institutional resources, unregulated use of restrictive practices used in ways disproportionate to need, caregiver stress, and the lack of appropriate carer skills may increase the risk of abuse in institutional care settings. Lastly, societal factors that increase this risk may include ageism, inadequate health and social support services, economic pressures, and finally, intergenerational conflict. So moving now to the last part of my presentation, I'll give a short summary of approaches to the prevention and intervention of elder abuse in Australia. So one way to think about prevention and intervention strategies is from a public health perspective. This approach focuses on three levels of intervention. Firstly, there's primary or universal interventions, which target whole communities or populations to prevent elder abuse. There are also secondary interventions that target particular at-risk populations to prevent or intervene early before problems get worse. And there's also tertiary interventions that respond to victims or perpetrators of elder abuse. Before looking at these in more detail, I think it's worth framing this discussion with some guiding principles that I think are helpful to consider when we think about how we should respond. So in 2017, the Australian Law Reform Commission published its final report on the inquiry into protecting the rights of older Australians from abuse. As part of its inquiry, the Commission made a series of recommendations that aimed to balance two guiding principles. The first is the principle of dignity and autonomy, and the second is the principle of protection and safeguarding. As the report recognised, these principles are sometimes in tension. So on one hand, there is the principle to recognise the dignity and autonomy of older people, which includes recognition of an older person's right to make decisions about their own life and their capacity and agency to do so. On the other hand, there is the principle of protection and safeguarding, which aims to respond to an older person's rights to safety and well-being in those cases where they are at risk of abuse and may not have the capacity to ensure that their rights are respected. So balancing these principles can be a challenge for practitioners and policymakers working with older people. And it's worth keeping these principles in mind when thinking about prevention and intervention strategies. So primary interventions. Primary interventions are mainly focused on preventing elder abuse. Prevention strategies tend to operate at a national or a state and territory level, and these can include legislation that's relevant to the prevention or remediation of forms of elder abuse. This includes both Commonwealth and state and territory-based legislation. There's also policy and practice frameworks. These exist more at a state and territory level and seek to guide practice in the areas of health, social welfare, and related areas of practice. Education and awareness strategies. These can be directed to older people, to the broader community, or particular professional sectors. And finally, there are sector-wide workforce development strategies that aim to increase the capability and support for particular professional sectors to help prevent abuse. So a major development in this area of national policy has been the National Plan to Respond to the Abuse of Older Australians, which was released earlier this year. And you can find a copy of the plan available on the Attorney General's Department website. And we'll also have a link to that plan on our website following this webinar. So secondary interventions, these involve two main kinds of strategies. The first is screening and risk assessment strategies. These are typically used in healthcare settings, although they may be used elsewhere. They aim to screen older people for known risk factors, make an assessment of the nature of risk, and determine an appropriate course of action in response to that risk. The other main kind of secondary intervention are social support and capacity building strategies, and these include caregiver and family support services, financial management and related services, legal assistance, and elder abuse helplines. The evidence is still emerging across all these strategies. However, what seems to be clear in the research is that social support is a key protective factor that helps reduce an older person's risk of abuse. Tertiary interventions, I'll move on to the next slide. Tertiary interventions aim to address the incidence and impact of elder abuse after it has occurred and typically targets either older adults who have been victims of abuse or the perpetrators. There are two main challenges in this emerging area. The first is the complexity of elder abuse that occurs in its multiple forms and combinations, as well as there's a lack of strong evidence that would inform effective programs and practices. Tertiary interventions may target different groups, including older people, carers and perpetrators of abuse, as well as families. So just looking at tertiary interventions targeting older people, the main types of interventions that appear in the research and policy literature focus on multidisciplinary and coordinated approaches. These strategies aim to bring together different kinds of professionals, such as social workers, legal professionals, and health and mental health practitioners to provide a holistic and tailored response to particular forms of abuse. There's also case management and advocacy strategies. These may be similar to multidisciplinary approaches, but rather than being managed by a team, they're facilitated usually by a case manager to assess an older person's support needs. There are also elder abuse helplines, which are another type of intervention that can advocate for an older person by providing advice and assistance to refer to other support services. And finally, emergency shelters, which can cater to the unique needs of older adults. So tertiary interventions targeting carers, I'm just running out of time, so I'll keep it quick. Less is known about interventions targeting carers, but the main kinds of interventions include psychoeducative support groups, anger management, and counselling. Broadly, the evidence to support these interventions is still emerging, but the positive results associated with these programs and practices relate more to improved knowledge and awareness or reduced anxiety or depression among carers, but not necessarily a reduction in the incidence of abuse itself. So finally, interventions that target families, again, they appear to be a relatively new and emerging area. These can include family mediation, family care conferences, and family-focused psychological or counselling approaches. So like interventions targeting carers or perpetrators, there's not a strong evidence base to demonstrate the effectiveness of these interventions in reducing the incidence or impacts of elder abuse as yet. But there's always research and evaluation going on in this space, so watch this space. However, as mentioned earlier, available evidence does indicate that healthy relationships with family members is a key protective factor. And so there's a good argument that family-focused interventions are an important site of intervention and should be developed further. So just to conclude, elder abuse is a complex phenomenon involving a range of abusive behaviours and experiences. Practitioners, policymakers, and researchers are encouraged to consider the various prevention and intervention strategies that we know, in particular, to think about working with others to develop coordinated approaches to address and respond appropriately to the abuse of older people. Thanks for listening, and I'll hand over to Megan.
Thank you very much, Adam, for that very comprehensive presentation. We're now going to hear from Megan Frost. Megan has a video to show us, so bear with us while we get this going. If you cannot see the video, we will provide a link to it in our resources section of the Join the Conversation page.
I never thought we'd become one of those families.
It's my home. I don't want to move out.
My lawyer says I've got a strong case.
It's not about the money.
I don't trust her. I feel so alone.
Nobody listens to me.
I don't know what she does with all my money.
She's so forgetful these days.
They think I've lost my marbles.
They can't look after themselves anymore.
Why should it be my responsibility?
She thinks she knows what's best for everyone.
I've got my own life to sort out.
They'd be better off with someone else looking after them.
She's not putting me in a home.
I wish they'd stop fighting.
I'm just trying to do what's best for everyone.
I can't even talk about it.
And I'm the coordinator of the Let's Talk Elder Mediation and Support Services. This is a project designed to mitigate the risk and respond early to elder abuse. In my presentation today, I'm hoping to describe the Let's Talk project to you, give you a sense of the work that we've done so far, and raise some of the challenges we face in working in this space. You've seen the video. So the Let's Talk Elder Mediation and Support Service is funded by the New South Wales Government's Domestic and Family Violence Innovation Fund. We're funded for 3 years and this is ending in June 2021. We actively seek feedback from clients and stakeholders and will continually revise, adapt, change and develop the service throughout this period and share our learnings. As with all the projects funded under the Innovation Fund, Let's Talk will be externally evaluated, and we do hope to be contributing to the evidence base for working this space. Relationships Australia New South Wales is a not-for-profit organisation, and our goal is to promote relationships that are safe, healthy, and strong. Backed by 70 years of experience, we offer judgment-free support to people of all cultural backgrounds, family structures, gender, and sexual orientation. Let's Talk is anchored in and builds on Relationships Australia, New South Wales, counselling and mediation services. And as mentioned before, the aims of Let's Talk is to mitigate the risk of and to respond early to elder abuse. So why Let's Talk? The name Let's Talk came from this project, emerged during conversations with the New South Wales Elder Abuse Helpline and Resource Unit as we were developing our proposal for funding. As just one example of the many changing and evolving aspects of the work, the helpline, as of the 1st of July this year, is now the New South Wales Ageing and Disability Abuse Helpline. The helpline became and still is a key partner in the Let's Talk project. We wanted to know if the helpline thought there was a need for mediation counselling services in New South Wales, specialising working with older people, their families, carers, friends, support people. Meeting with the helpline, we learned about the people who called the helpline. 46% of the callers were a concerned family member, 18% the older person themselves, and 14% a concerned bystander. All categories of elder abuse were reflected in the calls: sexual, physical, psychological, financial, and neglect, with the most frequent type of abuse being financial at 39% and psychological at 58%. And as mentioned by Adam, these often coexist. When speaking with callers, the helpline noticed a predominant theme is that people want to preserve family relationships. They want to be safe. They don't want to lose relationships. One of the questions the helpline frequently asks callers is, have you thought about talking with the other people concerned? Have you thought about talking with your adult child, whom you love and are fearful of losing? Have you thought about talking with your parent who you don't want to frighten about their money? Have you thought about talking with your sibling, who you haven't spoken to for 3 years, to see if they actually do have a power of attorney? Have you thought about talking to your sister-in-law, who your aunt lives with now, and you can't see your aunt anymore? It's too hard. I don't know where to start. They wouldn't want to talk to me. I don't want to make things worse. Yes, there is a need to help people come together to have important and sometimes difficult conversations. There is a need to help families manage conflict and make decisions. The Let's Talk service can help bring families together to start the conversation about age-related issues, such as intergenerational relationship challenges, risk, safety and well-being, planning for the future, powers of attorney and guardianship, end-of-life planning and decision-making. Let's Talk ensures the voices of older people are heard, the rights of older people are known and upheld, the wishes of older people are respected, and relationships are supported and strengthened. It's also important to know and help connect people to what other services might be able to assist them. A brief outview of Let's Talk in what clients can expect is just that no pathway is exactly the same. We understand that people have different needs and wishes, so we ensure that we spend time to understand why the person has contacted our service. We tailor the service and how it is delivered to the needs of each client group. That said, there are some key service connection points. So someone can come to the Let's Talk service either by calling or contacting the service themselves. They might be an older person, they might be a family member. We've also worked hard at developing relationship with other services, and referrals may actually come from another service provider. We call the first appointment that a client has with our service the initial consultation, and this is conducted with a family advisor who's got training and skills in counselling and also in elder mediation. In this phone call, we are seeking to understand the concerns, what we might be able to offer, refer to other support, give information about going forward, talk about who else might be involved in moving forward and who else might need some information. If people choose to go forward from that, we then arrange a face-to-face appointment, though we can do appointments over the phone as well. And this will either be what we call a pre-mediation interview, or it might be that the decided pathway forward for this particular group is that counselling might be the best pathway forward. As I said, it can be by phone, but most often in one of our Relationships Australia offices. We are flexible and have arranged to use other people's offices, meeting community rooms to be closer to clients. More information about moving forward and what support people might need, perhaps counselling before coming together in mediation, and what also information people might need about making decisions, their legal, medical, financial and other supports. We look at who needs to participate and how. We invite other people in for the same pre-mediation or counselling appointment. Elder mediation is a forum for decision making where family members are encouraged to express their concerns. Decisions are confidential and take place in a private and safe setting. The core principle guiding elder mediation is that the voice of the older person is heard, their rights upheld and their wishes represented. For mediation to be effective, it is preferable for all interested parties to attend or be represented, though at times this is a challenge. Agreements reached are based on goodwill and not legally binding. Services are voluntary and confidential, and limits to confidentiality are discussed at the outset and include reporting if there are concerns about safety or otherwise we're compelled by law. There's some links here to the Let's Talk Elder Mediation Support Service, and this is a New South Wales service, though Relationships Australia New South Wales is part of a national network of Relationships Australia services, and they have senior relationship services as well. In fact, four of our states are trial sites for the Federal Attorney General's Elder Mediation and Case Management. Let's Talk was launched on the 12th of June this year, and we're able to offer in the Sydney metropolitan area in Mandarin and Cantonese as well, as we have two mediators who speak both Mandarin and Cantonese. We're committed to providing work in regional parts of New South Wales as well. From Relationships Australia New South Wales, we have two mediators and counsellors trained in elder mediation based from our office in Bathurst. And one of our other key partners is Relationships Australia Canberra and Region. So Let's Talk is also offered in the Riverina from Wagga and in the far south coast from Moruya. The design of Let's Talk was informed by a national trial that Relationships Australia ran in 2016. Key learnings from that trial included the need to build strong collaborative partnerships with key stakeholders and service providers, as well as the challenge and priority to work creatively, thoughtfully and safely when inviting older people, family members and support networks to come together to talk. And the paper of that trial written by Paula Matz is a link on your slides. Let's Talk is also building on the international body of work that has been undertaken in elder mediation. Elder mediation is relatively new in Australia, particularly when compared with other countries such as Canada. And I've chosen an article here for you written by Judith McCann-Berringer, as it describes various models of mediation and different ways that elder mediation can be used in working with older people and their families, different contexts. Judy was one of the keynote speakers at the National Mediation Conference in Canberra this year, and she's also one of the trainers of advanced elder mediation that I attended with the Relationships Australia colleagues this year, and greatly appreciate learning from her. Let's Talk is delivered by qualified mediators and counsellors who have also had specialised elder mediation training. We are committed to growing in our knowledge and skill. We already have one elder mediator who is applying for international accreditation as an elder mediator. This bar is really high, and at last look, only three Australians have this accreditation, and we expect others to be in a position to apply later this year. Our initial elder mediation training was delivered by Dale Bagshaw, and Dale is one of those three people and is one of the leaders of elder mediation and work in elder abuse in Australia. She was also involved in the revision of the International Elder Mediation Code of Ethics, which is a link for you. One of the key elements in elder mediation training and elder abuse training is recognising ageism and understanding ageism. Ageism can impact how we see and value older people. It can also impact whether we see or listen to older people. And I note that Adam mentioned ageism in his presentation. I'd like to draw your attention, in case you haven't heard of it yet, to the Every Age Counts campaign, a campaign to tackle ageism faced by older Australians. For me, a disturbing illustration of ageism appears in research undertaken with social workers. I became aware of this research in the Helpline's training for professionals on elder abuse. In a study of social workers in 2013, two groups of social workers were shown an identical account of domestic violence against a woman. The only difference in the case study that they were shown is one woman was aged 77 years old and in the other 37 years old. Results found that the abuse was considered significantly less serious when the victim was older. The only difference was the age of the female victim. Ageism, the prejudice against our future selves, it's been called, can limit people recognising elder abuse, and it can also influence the way the practitioners conceptualise a case and plan their work. For example, who we speak to and who we invite to be part of a process. As part of the Let's Talk project, all Relationships Australia New South Wales will be trained in elder abuse recognition and responding. We will ensure that older people are visible, that when exploring the impact of domestic and family violence, as well as attending to the impact of children, we explore whether or not there may be an older person who might also be affected. Older people will be visible. Let's Talk has a commitment to hear directly from the older person. However, there's a challenge. Are there times when we would not speak directly with the older person? If we have made that choice with careful planning and consideration, how do we ensure that the voice and the wishes of the older person are represented and are present? I'll give you a case example. A family member approached the Let's Talk service on the suggestion of from a worker at Dementia Australia. The caller was an adult child who was concerned about the care of their parent who had been diagnosed with one of the dementias. The concern was serious that the parent was at risk of not being adequately cared for, as the caller was the main carer and could no longer provide the care needed. The caller thought the parent needed to be moved into a home. For this family, the caller, their siblings, and the older person's spouse all agreed that they were the ones who needed to talk together. The worker from Dementia Australia met with our mediator before the mediation and agreed to attend the beginning of the mediation to speak with the family, to let them know what the care needs might look like in the future and what support might be needed and also where assistance can be found. There were multiple challenges. The adult children hadn't seen eye to eye for a while. One felt like they carried the burden of care, the other felt excluded. And there were pressures for everyone in other aspects of their lives, whether it be personal relationships, care of other people, or work. Let's Talk help these people make decisions that enabled the older person to stay at home. There was a better understanding of each person's needs and fears, a better understanding of service options. There were action plans to follow up support service. The initial caller was able to let people know that they were feeling overburdened. This enabled others to offer more help. And the adult siblings have entered counselling to improve their relationship. Let's Talk also is committed to ensuring that the rights of older people are known and upheld. When I'm thinking about rights, we can think about things in lots of ways. And one of the areas I don't want to skip but can't spend much time on is just thinking about human rights. For those of you who may have been at the National Elder Abuse Conference, there was a speaker in Brisbane earlier this year, Bethany Brown, who is a researcher of older people's rights at the United States Human Rights Watch, was a keynote speaker. And her keynote address was entitled, Human Rights Don't Evaporate When We Get Old. Our rights to dignity, self-determination, liberty, security, equality, non-discrimination don't evaporate when we get older. And again, although I'm in New South Wales, I do notice that South Australia does have a charter of rights and freedoms of older people. In terms of one of the areas that we've noticed with a lot of our calls is, and so far we've conducted over 70 initial consultations, issues of concern that have prompted the call have included financial abuse and concern about the management of finances and assets, as well as family relationship conflict. We've noted there's a lot of uncertainty amongst callers about what in New South Wales we have as power of attorney and also we have guardianship, what they entail, and many report the misuse of these powers, leading to reports of financial abuse. It's really important when working in this space as professionals that we understand the legal documents in our context, that we understand what documents give powers of decision making, what those decisions can be, and also how people might be able to change those instruments. So the limits, the nature of the decisions, when it can be changed, people need some information about this. We've had, for example, someone who thought because their parent had gone into an aged care facility, that the aged care facility was then the guardian of that person and got to make all the decisions. So getting information to people about their legal status, the status of decision making, is really important. If you don't understand legal documents or if you're not sure, ask for help. I know each state has legal services that produce a lot of information and advocacy services as well. For example, in New South Wales, the New South Wales legal aid website is fantastic. It's got lots of fact sheets and resources. And one of the sheets that I think is one of the helpline has mentioned is most downloaded is adult children living at home, how to get them to leave. The New South Wales Trustee and Guardian also have lots of resources on their website and include things to help people consider planning ahead. What documents might they need to ensure that the decisions that they want to be made for them, should they not be able to make the decisions themselves, are made? And also in terms of advanced care directives as well. So just thinking around, there's a lot of information and resources out there. Giving people legal information doesn't mean they're starting legal action. It doesn't mean they're fighting a legal battle. It means that people understand the context in which decisions are made, and people need that information when they're making decisions and thinking and planning for the future. Let's talk safety. Relationships Australia is committed to positively and appropriately addressing issues of safety, including family and domestic violence, elder abuse and the abuse and neglect of children and young people. So Let's Talk follows our client safety procedures, which include, and I'll just touch on them, screening, ongoing assessment of risk and suitability of service, safety planning and referral. As mentioned before, referral might be for legal support or legal information. It might be that we've heard something that has us being concerned about the safety or well-being of someone, that it might be a situation of a possible elder abuse. And there's the New South Wales Ageing and Disability Abuse Helpline. Now, as of the 1st of July in New South Wales, we have an Ageing and Disability Commissioner, and that commissioner has investigative powers with respect to elder abuse. So this is new for us, again, part of the changing landscape. We may also refer to the police if there are emergencies or crimes. And we do have in New South Wales, that's just starting, is that the New South Wales Police are establishing specialised elder abuse liaison officers. So in New South Wales, we already have domestic and violence liaison officers and multicultural liaison officers who have been able to work with and speak with around cases. And we are now also having elder abuse liaison officers. I'd like to refer you to the New South Wales Elder Abuse Toolkit. It's linked in, and it is, again, a source of much information. It has a five-step approach to identifying and responding to the abuse of older people. It includes tools for screening and assessment, heaps of information and practical support. For example, a policy checklist if you're wanting to write an agency policy in relation to the abuse of older people. We have as a challenge in working with safety the fact that we're dealing with older people and adults who are able to make decisions, and family members may not like some of the decisions that people make. They might not think they're the best decision, but people are entitled to make bad decisions. So some of the dilemmas are, when is something someone's choice, their autonomy, their decision to do what they want with their money, their decision not to tell their adult children what their plans are with their wills, their decisions to choose who their executors might be or who they might give their powers of attorney to, and when is it something that's actually impacting their safety, and that the context of support and other services actually needs to be there to safeguard people. We don't have all the answers to this, but we do grapple with these challenges. And I think when we're working in this space, these are challenges to grapple with. We cannot undo this work in isolation. We're developing referral pathways and building working relationships with many services. These include the Ageing and Disability Abuse Helpline, Seniors Rights Service, Dementia Australia, New South Wales Police, General Practitioners, and apologies for that apostrophe if anyone's noticed it. We've actually found talking to GPs with consent from clients has really helped us bridge the gap that some people have with their understanding of my aged care, how to get assessments, how to actually start entering into the My Aged Care system to get the support and the services. A lot of people don't know, and sometimes they've had assessments and hadn't realised that they had their assessments. So again, with permission with people, we've been able to help them get the information they need to then access services for themselves. We also have designated community engagement work in Bathurst, Wagga, Maroochydore and Metropolitan Sydney. And this is to help to raise the awareness, but also to build working relationships with other services. When thinking about this work, we've been thinking around each family, and in each family, planning is unique, and the time that's taken to listen, to plan, to think, to follow up, particularly on referrals and making sure that people have landed with the service that's able to support them. We've noticed and are concerned about a lot of people, and particularly the older people, being referred to a service that may not quite be the right one for them, and they tend to bounce around a little bit. So we're trying to do a lot of work in making sure before they arrive that we actually have picked the right service for them, and if it hasn't been, that we're able to work out what might be of benefit for them. Being aware of ageism, keeping this in front of mind, our own experiences, our own thoughts are impacted by living in an ageist world, and working with clear statements that help challenge ageist assumptions that inform and maybe even define the issue of the caller. For example, the adult's children's sense of entitlement to parents' financial resources. We might reframe the conversation, say, for example, your mum and dad may or may not choose to let you know their plans for their money or how they spend it. And just again, acknowledging that for workers and for us all in this space, that it's often very close to home. These issues and challenges are close in our families, in our friends, with our neighbours. And it is important that, as always, we ensure that we don't impose our own values, our own thoughts, or the own choices that we've made on others, as well as ensuring that we take care of staff working in this space with good support and good supervision. I'd like to leave you with some statements that our clients have made. I really feel hopeful that things might improve. I'm so glad I contacted you. I thought there was nothing I could do. You feel so helpless. It's great to know that there are options and people who can help. I feel I'm moving forward and have a plan. I feel more confident to contact my son and try to work things out now that I have some support. Thank you for keeping us safe and on track. Thank you, Rachel. Over to you.
Thanks very much, Megan, for that very informative and insightful presentation. And now we're going to turn to questions from the audience. We've had a question that asks whether you could talk a little more, Megan, about the potential risks in responding to elder abuse with mediation, whether it puts the responsibility on the older person who's the victim.
Yes. So as with all our mediation services, whether it be family dispute resolution or elder mediation, before we even decide on going down that pathway, we make sure that it is safe to do so. So if there is a situation where people aren't safe or we aren't confident that they're safe, we will not be bringing people together to have those conversations. We might contact a person and then refer them for support and work with that family. But depending on what kind of situation it is, it's hard to say exactly which pathway we take forward, but we definitely don't proceed unless we are confident that people are safe, either with their living and with planning. And if if we are aware of concerns, we actually do, with the consent of the person usually, make connections with the Elder Abuse Helpline.
Excellent. We've had some questions about the alleged perpetrators and working with alleged perpetrators, so I might group these questions together, if that's okay, Megan, and address them to you. The first question, sure. The first question asks, I'm wondering if you know if there's much evidence on how to work with, in parentheses, male perpetrators of elder abuse. Would it be this similar or the same as the model for working with perpetrators of general family violence? The questioner goes on to say, I'm curious, as I know the model for working with perpetrators is underlined by gender. However, I'm guessing for elder abuse, it would be more informed by an understanding of ageism. And then another questioner asks about Relationships Australia's work with alleged perpetrators and the framework that you use in working with those perpetrators.
Okay. I'd like to just make some general statements, and if I don't fully answer your question and with some more reflection, I'll make sure that what the written responses fully address the questions. Some points to start with is, in elder abuse, yes, there are some classic presentations of intimate partner violence and domestic and family violence that we're used to working in a lot of our services. We also see, in terms of working with the families and where there are allegations of elder abuse, that potentially people are not so intentional and of their abuse. For example, I'll give you an example of financial abuse. Absolutely, you might be a rat bag out there to fleece your older parent, but sometimes what happens is you don't actually realise the limits of what you should be doing. People's sense of entitlement, they don't realise that it's actually wrong to pocket the change. We did it as teenagers, but actually as we're getting older, if we're shopping for people and that the use of technology for banking, for example. So some of the areas of abuse and some of the perpetrators, once you actually let them know and reinstate rights and choices, people can sometimes realise going forward that things need to change, particularly if things have been raised by siblings. So the challenge is to get the person who might have been accused by their family members together to the table to listen. In terms of I can't remember the second part of your question. I'm really sorry.
So that was in relation to...
The gendered work. So in terms of who the perpetrators are as well, it's daughters as well as sons. So some of the gendered work is a bit different in elder abuse. There still seems to be more women victims to male victims. I don't have a full understanding of that. But it is different. It is different to our classic work with domestic and family violence. But then at different times it's the same as well. So the principles around safe guarding, safety planning and screening and assessment and an ongoing assessment of, is this the right service and what else might people need, underpins the work.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Megan. I'm afraid we don't have any time for further questions, but thank you for attending today, and please follow the link on your screen to our website to continue the conversation. And as you leave the webinar, a short survey will open up in a new window, and we would greatly appreciate your feedback. Please note that any unanswered questions may be published along with your first name on the CFCA website for a response from presenters after the webinar. Please let us know if you don't want your question or your first name to be published on our website. Thank you, Megan. Thank you, Adam. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Good afternoon.